Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It's a growing trend. Free speech around the world is under assault. The powers that be claim truth can only be found through moderation. The rest of us just demand the right to dissent. Crosstalking free speech, I'm joined by my guest, Lionel in New York. He's a legal and media analyst. In Colorado, we have Natalie Morris. She is host of the Redacted podcast. And in Beirut, we cross to Esteban Carrillo. He is news desk editor for The Cradle. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Lionel, let me go to you first here. I mean, so much is happening in around the issue of free speech. We have everything that's surrounding around Elon Musk in Brazil. We have Pavel Durov in Paris that has been arrested. He is the CEO of Telegram. And then multiple individuals being arrested and interrogated for their views. Sometimes their homes are being searched, documents being confiscated. Under the very thin veneer of the law, which I want to talk to you about later. But ultimately, I'd like to ask all three of our guests on this program today, is that traditionally, and I know it varies from country to country, that freedom of speech is a right, not a privilege, but it seems to be inverted now. It's a privilege to be able to speak your mind in public and not a right. Go ahead, Lionel.
You know, Peter, I've always been used, and many of us have been used to the fact that speech in one form or another, whether it's music, and from our generation, from music to musical lyrics to TV shows, there's always been somebody saying, you can't do that, that's wrong, that's filthy. That's harmful in some respects. But that was about it. You know, people would say that, and we thought, this is awful. What I'm finding so fascinating today, it's not so much that people are not allowed to speak, but it's this ham-handed, physical, brute force pulled out of your house, passports grabbed, you're under arrest. If you had told me a couple of years ago that you would have had people arrested for posting on social media. Think about that, oxymoronic. Social media, not threats, not promises to conduct violence, but merely to present an observation or an idea that was considered inconsistent with something, I would have thought, you're out of your mind. That will never happen. And look at us now.
You know, Natalie, Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, had an op-ed in The Guardian, and it's really gotten a lot of press, and for good reason. He essentially says that Elon Musk is out of control. I'm not sure how to interpret that. I mean, he is in control of Twitter, and the whole issue of control is really at the center of this. Who should have the control? And in his article, which echoes so many people in the liberal ecosphere, is that moderation should be controlled by, except for us. Somebody else has to moderate us, okay? I'm not really sure what that means, except for it sounds coercive. Go ahead, Natalie.
Well, right, but it's an apparent plea for what they want to control, what anybody who can't control the populace wants to control through the platforms. Now, we see the history of media, and media control was quite easy in the 80s and 90s when there were just a few news channels that were compliant as a mouthpiece of the state. What they didn't plan for was that the internet would take that power away from them, allow us to question the narrative, and now they cannot control it any longer. So in this piece, which I think is just petulant and also shameful, he doesn't say what harm there is from free speech, other than the fact that it may be promoting Trump, which he clearly doesn't like. But what is the rest of the harm? Calling somebody a certain name, calling somebody something you don't like. And also, we've seen Zuckerberg apologize for censorship. And he even himself said, in hindsight, I would not have done this. I find that a really unacceptable explanation of what he should have known. There should not have required hindsight to know that questioning a narrative is acceptable in any form or fashion, whether it be the COVID vaccine, whether it be Hunter Biden's laptop, any questions should be acceptable. And now the fact that we're trying to censor even questioning of narrative is terrifying.
And again, you know, going back to the Reich piece here, I mean, he goes off and say people should be arrested. Well, and that's not the rule of law. I mean, what is the case you're making? And they can't do right. that. And that's what's really frightening. Esteban, you know, this is all accelerated in my mind, at least, considering what's going on, the genocide that's going on in Gaza. This is what has terrified so many people, the powers that be, because a different narrative is out there. And that narrative is dominant all around the world. I would even go as far as saying it's very powerful, at least in the West. It's dominant around the rest of the world. And they are terrified that this particular narrative, which they have coveted for decades now, is way out of their control. And this is, we're seeing a knock-on effect. They can use this example. If you claim there's a genocide going on, they just extrapolate through everything else. The Hunter Biden laptop, COVID, et cetera, et cetera. But this is the centerpiece that they're so terrified of. Getting rid of TikTok in the United States because of that reason. Go ahead, Esteban.
Exactly. No, 100%. You know, and I think Gaza, beyond just being a tipping point, it caught them with their pants down in a way, right? The situation that was sparked on 7 October, because the West, you know, Israel at the forefront, but then the collective West immediately lost control of the narrative. It was a sight to see, in all honesty. It was something that we didn't see happen when the Ukraine war started. We didn't see happen, obviously, before, you know, in the many other wars that the United States has fueled. Gaza became a complete tipping point, to the point, as you were saying, that they're dragging people out of their houses. They are arresting people at airports. They are just for a social media post, which is, you know, beyond anything we could have imagined just a few years ago, but now it's common practice. And it's a show of how much the losing the narrative has affected the Western powers in particular, because the situation of the Palestinians in particular was not an unknown, was not, you know, something that was new really to anyone who was paying attention. In particular, I was saying in the Global South. In the Global South, we had an understanding of what the reality was. But then when the West started to see these things, be at the same tools that at one point were supposed to, you know, liberate and democratize information via YouTube, via TikTok, via Instagram, via whatever, that's when the clampdown started, right? To the point that we at the Cradle a few weeks ago, we were banned from Meta for allegedly supporting terrorist organizations, when in reality, what we were doing was telling the reality of what's happening on the ground.
Well, Esteban, one of your colleagues at the Cradle said to me before we went on vacation this program is that the only adults in the room are coming from the Global South. I think that's something we can talk about in another time here. You know, Lionel, it's all been mentioned in this program here. I mean, why all the show of force? Why do you need a SWAT team to show up and, you know, and to say, what are you doing on social media? I mean, can you just say, can they send you a message and say, can you come and meet us tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock at your convenience? I mean, because just as you said, no violence has been admitted. No, there's no threat to violence going on. I mean, what? Why the show of force?
Oh, well, because
let me go to Lionel first on that one. I know everybody wants to talk about
the
that.
Narrative.
Hey, hang on, Natalie. Let me go to Lionel first on, then I'll go to you. Go ahead, Lionel.
Oh, Peter, my naive gentleman friend. You know, in law school, those of us who were studying always heard that before the government can do something, there had to be a clear and present danger. And CGI was always a compelling governmental interest. It was the highest thing. You had to do something that posed an imminent threat of something that you're not an idea, not an ideation, not a hope, not a wish, not a desire, but you were going to do something to bomb, to destroy, and that was wrong, or you were defaming somebody. It was easy. If I had to go back and tell current law students, my favorite misinformation, disinformation, that information, these hate, anti-Semitism. And I thought, wait a minute, What, this is an idea. I'm so naive. Okay, fine. Are you saying that saying something that not is anti-Semitic, but that you consider to be anti-Semitic, that you can shut me down? And they look at you and they say yes. And to answer your question, Peter, the reason why it's so ham-fisted and brute force is to habituate and to condition and to make people realize, well, that's the way it is. This is this new, brave new world we live in, and it's to acclimate us, to habituate us, so that we're used to it. You can get Americans and people around the world to stand in line, to wear a mask, to be poked and jabbed, and to completely distrust that inner sense of right and wrong, which unfortunately the human race has abandoned.
But that's saying tyranny will keep us safe. Okay, Natalie, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that all of this use the force is having the chilling effect for those of us who want to ask questions, who want to leave a safer and freer world for our children, is that we feel afraid. Will they come to our house next? Have I said something afoul of the narrative? And it's working clearly, because those of us who are independent journalists have to now ask ourselves these questions and how safe each thing is, and how do I frame this in a way that I don't get kicked off the platform, that are controlled by the government narrative. I mean, you know, it makes us do a dance to make sure that we can at least ask the questions. And it's a conversation with our audience now. Like, I'm asking this question. Do you know what I'm saying? And we're inferring something that we're afraid to say.
Yes, I mean, I've experienced, I remember when COVID had started here and all of the censorship that was going on Facebook. And I think it was Daniel McAdams, a good friend of the program here. And we ended up speaking in word salad. And at the end of it, we're just like, why are we doing this? Are we so afraid? And then we stopped doing it. And there was no penalty. Yeah. But you're right. It was upfront. You have to censor yourself. Esteban, do you want to jump in before we go to the break? Go ahead, in Beirut.
No, I think I agree with the sentiment entirely, but I see it from afar, right? Like, I feel like there is a benefit to being outside of nations that are doing this persecution. And this is why it scares them so much. This is why they sanctioned RT just yesterday, the U.S. Treasury, because they know that they can't go and break down their house. They can't come and break down our doors here at the cradle. They can't come and break down the door of RT. All they can do is make them look like the bad guy constantly and silence them. But for the people in the U.S., well, I fear for you.
Yeah, well, but as I put on X, I said this is the third season of Russiagate. Remarkably, it's been brought back. There was low viewership, but they've brought it back. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on free speech. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing free speech. Okay, let's go back to Lionel in New York. I mean, we've all mentioned during the course of this program the word narrative. There are many narratives. There are conflicting narratives. There are opposing narratives. But narratives are made up of words, okay? So let's play a game here, or at least maybe explain to me, what does misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation mean to you, Lionel? Because it's invoked all of the time, but it's right, never defined, and hardly ever an example is presented to us. So take your pick. You got three words. Choose one.
Okay, well, let me go back to what I think used to be the narrative of our jurisprudence, and for the most part around the world. I had the burden. If I were to say something, for example, if I were to tell you that, let's say, hey, kids, drinking broken glass is good for you, or something where you can say, wait a minute, hold it, stop. It's kind of self-explanatory. Also, somebody who claimed that you were doing something had the burden of proving it. Adding to the narrative now, which is the most fascinating compared to what I remember, was that you have now the government that says there's no state action here. I'm not telling you, and I'm not telling you wonderful people what you can and can't say. It's X. It's Twitter. It's some server. It's Facebook. We're not doing that. course, Mark Zuckerberg admitted that he is being used as a proxy, as an accomplice. So the government is using these platforms that have addicted people to this thing called communication and the expression of ideas. Imagine that. How wonderfully addictive, where we're used to that. And they do the dirty work. The government has clean hands. We never told you to do this until the Twitter memos came out and Zuckerberg. That's the latest. That's the angle. It's as though the government is saying, you provided the misinformation. But by the way, don't look at us. Look at your particular platform.
Yeah, well, Natalie, I mean, the most of what the authorities claim is misinformation and disinformation comes from them. It doesn't.
Right.
We're commenting on it and we're questioning it, and that's why that gets us all in all kinds of trouble, because we question their misinformation and disinformation, and now it's being criminalized. Go ahead.
Right. Well, here's my favorite example. Last year, the European Commission commissioned a study for where misinformation was most prevalent, and they found it, and they defined it in a very mysterious way, such as things about COVID, which end up being true, things about gender, which end up being true. So they had all of these parameters under which they were measuring disinformation, and they said they found it in Spain, in France, in these communities, and it's rife on Twitter over Facebook versus TikTok, whatever. They say it's worse on Twitter. So they took it to the press, and the press ran the headline saying Russian disinformation is prevalent on Twitter over other press. Oh, when you read the study did not try to identify where this disinformation came from at all. The European Commission spun it in order to get this narrative out. So they used a study about misinformation, a spurious study. They used a study about misinformation to perpetuate misinformation. The study said nothing about Russia. That's what they wanted. So usually when you see misinformation, it's a canary in a coal mine for a narrative they want to control. And if we pull the thread, which I have made my job to pull the thread, then we usually find a lie behind it, guised as a lie. And it's infuriating. And that's why I refuse to use this word, because information is information. It's up to us to digest it and decide if it's true or not.
Well, that's the whole point, dear, is that, I mean, the way I was brought up, I guess Lionel and I are in the older part of the group here, is that, you know, good information, if there's bad information or bad opinions, have good information and good opinions, you know, drown it out. That's the way it used to work. And it kind of worked pretty well. Esteban, you know, I gave three words at the top of the second part of this program. Let's talk about malinformation, because I think that's the most pernicious, because that's an admission that the information itself may be true, but the way it is used, it is invoked, it is spread, is not. And again, this goes back to what's going on in Gaza on the West Bank. You know, yes, there is a slaughter going on, but don't put it in the present case, put it in the passive voice, and that'll be acceptable as information. They're trying to scramble everyone's minds here, but my eyes do not lie to me. I can pick up this phone right now and stream to you what's going on there right now. They are not lies. It is completely unfiltered. Go ahead.
Exactly. You know, like the definition of malinformation, this new world, it really just boils down to an inconvenient truth. Something that is true, but it's simply inconvenient. But inconvenient to whom, right? To those in control, to those who are used to controlling the narrative. So like an example of that would just be Israel is bombing a host. Israel is bombing a UN convoy. Or just look at any headline from AP, from Reuters, from the New York Times, talking about the deaths of Palestinians. If you were to read this, you would assume these people are just dropping dead out of the blue. You know, they're just killed by coincidence, I would guess. But they never name Israel. They avoid, they go out of their way. And I think this is a bit of a negative example of malinformation. I mean, like an opposite example of it, of being like, we cannot say the truth because it's inconvenient, because it doesn't fit the narrative. And we've already lost control of the narrative to such a large extent that we can't continue to feel this. And what we can do now is just start targeting anyone and everyone who's getting any traction in speaking the truth, in showing reality, right? And it's unfortunate that it's inconvenient for them, but I would call it that it's convenient for everyone else, for humanity, for all of us. to know what's really happening and to know who's in control and to know, in particular, in the case of Gaza, who is sending the weapons almost on a daily basis that are then being dropped on the heads of Palestinian children.
Yeah, you know, Lionel, do you remember the case of Alex Jones when he was disappeared?
Oh, yeah.
He was deleted and those of us that were watching, I'm not a fan of the gentleman, okay? But he has a right to speak, okay? And no one forces people to listen to him, all right? Okay, he's been brought back. But it seems to me what's going on with Telegram, with what's going on with Twitter or X, whatever you prefer to call it, these are seen as outliers, but I think they want to show it as an example and maybe make it the trend, okay? I could foresee where social media has to be completely either gotten rid of or completely tamed. I don't see a middle ground here. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, the courts have to, first of all, remove it from the notion that it is somehow this completely, totally private thing that nobody can talk. It's regulated. I mean, the power company is not private. Let me tell you something, a couple of historical references. Do you remember, Peter, years ago, the Anarchist Cookbook? This was in 1971, the Supreme Court. This was the book that showed you how to make bombs,
yep.
How to kill people, how to make silencers and poisons. And they said, well, that's information. Talk about malinformation. To show you how bad it was, recently, Lex Fridman was talking to, and this was very interesting, to Donald Trump. And everybody was saying, oh, how great that was. Even Lex Fridman was talking about the idea that perhaps, maybe, through some kind of weird hallucinogenic fluke, that Donald Trump may have thought that maybe the 2020 election might have been either stolen or tampered with, and because he didn't want to be called an election denier. And once I label something conspiracy theorist, or as Gore Vidal says, a conspiracy analyst, but once I give you a name and you say, oh, I know what that is, you're so careful because once I, that's misinformation, that's that information. Yes, it's our duty to challenge it. But all of a sudden, look what they tried to do one time to Joe Rogan, claiming that he was using horse dewormer when he said, and by the way, there's a lawsuit on that. So the thing is, if he said this, if let's assume he actually said, yes, I use horse dewormer, turn it off. You're going to shut down the platform because of this? Peter, in the old days, if I called you up and made an obscene phone call, nobody shut the phone company down. Nobody shut the post office down because I mailed you something. We're going after the platform versus the information without even questioning whether it's true or even harmful.
Yeah, but Natalie, isn't really the canary in the mine shaft here. I mean, you've already brought up Donald Trump. You've already brought up Russiagate. These are just the pegs that they hang their hat on. I mean, this is a way to drive forward the censorship here. They use these two issues as a reason. Essentially, they just want censorship and they want control. And they use these ridiculous reasons to shut people down. Because I think it's much bigger than just Trump or Russia or Israel. I think it's the whole ball of wax. Go ahead, Natalie.
Sure, it is. And there are a couple of ways that we are manipulated to buy into this. Number one, as Lionel said, is we don't want to be called these names. We don't want to be called transphobic or a TERF or an anti-vaxxer or any a Putin apologist. These are all things that I've been called before. And you're like, wait, that shuts down the conversation. Let's not use these names. But the names are a Trump card, for lack of a better term. Another way that we're manipulated is we're told that hate speech is something we cannot handle. We cannot hurt other people's feelings. Other people cannot abide having their feelings hurt. We're too sensitive for this. And the real world harm is that somebody might harm themselves because we are a sensitive populace. So if we buy into these two things, number one, name calling to shut down conversation, and number two, avoiding discomfort, we play into the ability to shut down narratives. And this is something that scares me, is for all of us to buy into this liberal tenet that you can't hurt feelings. People can't take it. These certain groups. It's also very infantilizing to the groups
if I want to be racial
groups, you can't hurt their feelings because they can't take it. Well, what does that say about those people, that we don't respect certain people's strengths?
I read the New York Times because I have to. It's part of my job. Yeah, do I have thoughts of suicide because I think of the ridiculous absurdness? No, of course not. I'm an adult. I know how to processed news here. We're almost out of time. Esteban, I said in the beginning, in my introduction, we all just want the right to dissent. That's going to be a rare privilege moving forward, to dissent.
100%. To be a dissenter is going to be against the law soon enough. Just to Natalie's point, you know, when about this control that is being exerted over what can be said and what cannot be said, I keep thinking back to, like, aren't books being rewritten now in the U.S.? Like all literature is just being redrafted, rewritten to fit the new times, I guess, the new narrative. It's a very scary situation when you really think about it. You know, this is not just about silencing dissent or dissenters. This is about having people march in lockstep towards a future in which freedom of speech is simply, you know, a slogan, just like anything else.
Yeah, well, they're building a dystopia, and they just are ordering everyone to find their place in it. And I'm sure I can speak for everyone on the program. I refuse. I simply refuse. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in New York, Colorado, and in Beirut. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules. Mm-hmm.